Please be seated, everybody. We'll call our next case, which is case number 61537, the State of Nevada versus Ricardo Robles Nieves. We have Mr. Rogan representing the appellant, Mr. Arroyo representing the respondent. Mr. Rogan, you may proceed with your opening argument. Would you like to reserve some time for rebuttal?
3 minutes, please, Your Honor.
Yes, you may. Thank you.
May it please the Court, Jeff Rogan for the appellant, the State of Nevada. This is an appeal from a pretrial decision of the 8th Judicial District Court suppressing the respondent's confession. The reasons given by, or the analysis used by the District Court in this particular case was an erroneous analysis, one that the District Court took from a Hawaii case, a Hawaii Supreme Court case called Kelly Colio. Forgive me if I'm mispronouncing that. In that particular case, the Kelly Colio case, the Hawaii Supreme Court noticed or differentiated between two types of fraudulent and deceptive practices by police during interrogations. Those two were identified as deceptive practices intrinsic, or facts intrinsic to the facts of the particular case, and then deceptive practices that utilized information that was extrinsic, outside the facts of the particular case. And in Kelly Colio, the Hawaii Supreme Court found that the police officer's use of fake evidence, alleging or telling the person that the suspect that he was interrogating that there were bruises on the victim of sexual assault and that there was incriminating physical evidence on that victim as well, linked the suspect, the person being interrogated, to the crime, and that induced the suspect to give a statement. This court used Kelly Colio in its subsequent decision, Sheriff v. Bessie, and it used it only in dicta as an example during during its evaluation of a similar case or a similar set of facts where fraudulent information was presented by police during an interrogation, and that fraudulent information induced the suspect to give a full confession. But this court never adopted it, and in my reading of Bessie, never intended to adopt the intrinsic versus extrinsic analysis versus the proper analysis that this court has always followed, which is the totality of the circumstances. And that was...
Mr. Rogan, did this happen, correct me if I'm wrong, did the officer in speaking Spanish to Mr. Nieves say to him that you're definitely going home to Mexico? I mean, inferring to him that he's not, you know, he's leaving, he's not going to be put under arrest further, and he's going to be able to be discharged and go back to Mexico as opposed to being charged with this murder, you know?
No, and that was one of the
issues. What happened then, like?
What happened was at the time that the police interviewed this, the respondent, he was in ICE custody. They had no probable cause to hold him for the murder. They believed that he was a suspect in the killing of the victim here. The victim refused to prosecute. He was alive for several weeks before he eventually passed away. He signed a request for no prosecution, and Detective Young went with another detective and interviewed him in ICE custody. At that time, he was hours or days away from being deported. If they didn't obtain a confession from him, they were not going to be able to arrest him and put him in custody for the killing of Fabian Rodriguez. When they went down there, they spoke to him and they informed him explicitly, you're going home. We have no power over you. We're not the federal authorities. We're police. We're just here to talk to you about the killing of Fabian Rodriguez. So there was never any promise. There was never any statement saying, we're not prosecuting no matter what you say. And to the contrary, in fact, what was said was, after a long talk about how he was being deported and he was going home and that the victim didn't want to prosecute, the police actually pointed out, the detective actually pointed out and said, but we want to know why. We need to know why. Even though the victim doesn't care and doesn't want to prosecute, we want to know what happened.
Counsel, are you suggesting, in response to Chief Justice Gibbons' question, that the police did not tell this gentleman he was going home when the following exchange occurred? They're talking about when he said, I'll tell you what you want to know, but turn the recorder off. Okay, you with me on where
yes,
that was?
Perfect.
He says, well, why don't you, the cop police says, why don't you want to do it with the recorder? Because I want to leave now. That is all. You will leave. You will go home. Answer, I know I won't. Answer, chuckle. You are going to go home.
I understood the question to be whether there was a deliberate exchange where the officer promised, and forgive me if my understanding of your question was wrong, where the officer said, you're not going to be arrested. That was the question that was posed to me. And that exchange that occurred doesn't actually have any kind of promise that was posed in the question.
Well, excuse me, Justice Sata, did I interrupt you?
No, go ahead.
At the record 1RA90, the defendant says, if you want to arrest me, arrest me. The detective says, no, sir. And then the defendant says, but I don't want to. And the detective says, sir, you are going home.
But again, it's not an explicit promise that no matter what he said, that he wouldn't be going home. And I don't even think that it's an implicit promise that he wouldn't be arrested. At the time that was said, the detective was correct. He couldn't arrest him. The respondent says, arrest me. And the detective says, no, I can't do that. That's what the detective is saying. And there's no explicit promise or implied promise in that exchange at all.
So simply, I'm sorry to belabor the point, but I must. So simply saying, you will go home, you will go home, you will go home, in your mind is not a promise that he will be able to go home if he just tells him.
Yes. Thank you. And that gets to the heart of the matter here is, was there an express promise made between the respondent and the police officers that there wouldn't be a prosecution? And the answer is quite clearly, no. Now, the issue before this court really is, though, is what test should be used to determine whether the statement given by Ricardo Robles Nieves was voluntary. Again, the district court used the Calicolio test, which is the wrong test. The proper test would be the test used by every federal jurisdiction, 49 out of the 50 states, excluding depending on how you look at those two cases, a couple appellate jurisdictions from other states, that the totality of the circumstances must be assessed. And you don't look to whether the fraudulent and deceptive practice are extrinsic facts or intrinsic facts.
So tell us about the totality of circumstances other than you'll go home, you'll go home, you'll go home.
That's certainly a factor that can be addressed in the totality of the circumstances, but it's not the only one.
But it's overwhelming. So tell me things that are as underwhelming as you can go home, you can go home, you can go home.
How about the fact that the respondent says, I know I won't go home? That's another essential question. Even if the police use deceptive tactics, which we all would agree would be deceptive, if the respondent is not deceived by them, what are we doing here? Are we saying that simply because the use of deceptive practices, we should preclude that and have a personal rule? We don't want police doing that. Anytime they do, regardless of what the motivation is, the actual motivation of the respondent is in confessing, we should exclude it. I would say no. The totality of the circumstances, you have to look not only.
Well, give me another totality. That was okay. I'll accept that one. Give me one more.
I would say the passive factors that we look to. We also need to look at the education level of the respondent. Is this a person who's going to be, who doesn't have the education or background that would be more susceptible to that kind of deception that was proffered to him? Or do they not? Are they lawyers? Are they judges? Or do they have a fourth grade education? Also, the length of the interrogation. Is the suspect been worn down to the point where he's just going to agree and he's reached that breaking point? All of those factors that have already been addressed in your previous case law would also be appropriate here. But in this case, what has been brought up, I think, is most important, is that the facts show that the respondent was aware, if we're going to assume that you're going home was a deceptive practice, that the respondent was aware of it and states, I know I'm not going home. Ask the police officer, ask the detective, turn off the recorder. Arrest me. Arrest me. He knew the consequences of his statement. He went into this with his eyes wide open, and he wasn't deceived by the police, if we are to assume that it was deceptive.
Does the record show us what his familiarity was with the system? I mean, you've also gone past the point that I clearly think there's a language barrier.
Yes.
Maybe not education, at least according to the record, but how about his familiarity with the process?
The record is devoid of that. When the district court made its decision by relying on Kelly Colio, it simply said this is extrinsic, per se, it's coercive. There were no factual findings made by the district court, and that would be something that would have to be addressed.
Was there an evidentiary hearing where evidence was presented?
There was an evidentiary
hearing. So why didn't the district attorney present it?
I'm sorry?
Why wasn't this, what does the state ask for, why wasn't that presented then?
We did present the evidence. We presented two detectives, Detective Young and Detective Embry, to testify about the contents.
But what about the familiarity of his background, his education, the interpreter? Was an interpreter good? Did the officer speak Spanish? Things like that. I mean, you had the right to present that to Judge Bell.
We did present some of that evidence. Detective Young is not a native Spanish speaker, but he's a fluent Spanish speaker. There was no interpreter. It was between him and Ricardo Robles Nieves. Now, with regard to his education background, that information we didn't have. We had no evidence to present that. That would have to come from the defendant himself, which, of course, we cannot call. His familiarity with the system. We only knew of, I think, a ticket that he had. We had no evidence that he was familiar or unfamiliar with that system. So it was not presented. We simply didn't have witnesses or evidence.
Well, how long was it between the time that he was actually arrested for the murder and he had this evidentiary hearing?
Gosh. I believe he was arrested in November of 2011. The evidentiary hearing was approximately a year ago, I think.
So there was plenty of time to find out what the district attorney needed to find out.
There was about 14 months between the time of the arrest and the time of the evidentiary hearing. I also do want to point out that even utilizing the Kelly Colio test, the district court actually got it wrong and failed to analyze whether, first of all, the statements were false statements, and then secondly, whether, if we're assuming that they are false, whether they are the deceptive practices were likely to produce false statements, which is the actual test under Kelly Colio. And if you actually look at the district court's decision, that analysis was never even rendered. They just looked at the question, assumed that there was a promise made, and because they looked at this as a per se coercive test, rendered the confession involuntary. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much. Mr. Arroyo. Mr. Arroyo, I'm going to ask you one question, too. A lot of my colleagues ask in different arguments and thinking about this. If we were to do an opinion in this case, what should it say regarding what is permissible deception to be used by the officers versus what isn't? Where do we draw the line on it? I'd be interested in your thoughts on that.
I would say that this court would just affirm Bessie that would adopt the rationale that Bessie adopted from the Colio court also. And that test would be extrinsic deception that's not part of the facts of the case that are likely to cause an untrue statement or to influence accused to make a confession, whether or not, regardless of guilt. If that concerns the court on how broad it is, we've asked the court to make a narrow rule that police cannot use deception which undermines Miranda, that is, confuses them as to the consequences to giving a statement, which I believe is pretty obviously done here, that Mr. Robles Nieves was not aware that his statement could be used against him, despite the warnings that were read to him early on. As Detective Young did read the Miranda warnings, but he had this deliberate tactic to undermine it. Right before he read the Miranda warnings, the first thing he says to Mr. Robles Nieves, I heard you want to go home. They're going to send you home. That's before he even reads the warnings. That, to me, seems like that's a tactic he's starting to butter him up to kind of lower his defenses. So we would ask that, at the very least, a rule or an opinion from this court set out a bright line rule that would prevent law enforcement from using those types of tactics that would confuse a defendant regarding the consequences of giving a statement. I wanted to discuss the factual you know, the factual interpretation of what happened during this interrogation. I think to start off, the district court's determinations are due deference. Under an involuntary review by this court, the ultimate decision is de novo, but any factual determinations surrounding the interrogation itself are due deference. In this case, the district court did find, you know, after reading the preliminary hearing transcript, after the evidentiary hearing, after reading the statement, did find that Detective Young did mislead Robles Nieves to believe that he was going home, that this case was done. That is something that the state has left out in their interpretation of what took place in during the interrogation. He not only said, you are going home, he said, this issue, this case, the one that we're questioning about, is done. It is done because the victim has all the rights, and he did not wish to prosecute. He also did make an implicit promise. I believe the record is on page part of the record where he says, you have to promise me that I'm going to go home, that you're not going to lock me up. At that point, Detective Young saying, yes, it's true, tell me. And then there's part of the transcript that says it's unintelligible, but we've had our own investigator, who is a native Spanish speaker, review the transcript, and we had her affidavit submitted to the district court that is part of the record. What she made out is that he said, that is it, I'm just going to go home, you're going to let me go, and that is it. To which Detective Young said, yes, it is true. So I think the district court's factual findings regarding that exchange is reasonable, and due deference that there was this implicit promise that after Robles Nieves said why he shot Sylvester, that he would go home after explaining why, so that there was no consequences. And as far as the controlling rule, in the district court, the state is the one that actually asserted that Bessie was the controlling law. Today, the state is advocating for totality of the circumstances, but at the district court level, they advocated saying that the general rule was confessions obtained through police deceptions are not vitiated so long as the methods used are not the type reasonably likely to procure an untrue statement. And I mean, that is the position they took in the district court. In their motions in the district court, they acknowledged that there was an implicit promise that would give the district court some reason to second guess this. But they said that the promise wasn't the type to lead to an untrue statement. We would say that the opposite, that this type of promise that was made to him, that there was no consequence, is the type that would lead to an untrue statement or get somebody to confess regardless of guilt. That's because when you look at the circumstances of this situation, Ricardo Robles Nieves had two encounters with the police regarding this. The first time he told them that he was in California. After that, they didn't have probable cause to arrest him, so they called ICE, and he was detained. Second time they came to interrogate him again, he also said, hey, I was in California, but Detective Young was using a textbook read interrogation where you don't accept that the defendant's denials of the situation and wouldn't accept it. And he suggests, well, we know you did it. Sylvester told us you did it. We're not here for that. We just want to know why. And then asked him suggests, well, you probably did it to protect yourself, right? So you have a situation where this is your second interrogation. The detective is not going to accept your version of events and then tells you that, hey, there is no consequence for making this statement. You probably did it to protect yourself. You can see a person in a coercive environment like that telling the detective what they want to hear in regards to, in the purpose of just ending the interrogation. And Ricardo Robles Nieves actually says that during the interrogation. He said, I just want to leave. He said, if this affects me, I don't want to talk. I just want to leave. To which Detective Young assured him that this won't affect you, that you know, you are going to leave otherwise. So
wouldn't it be okay for a detective to say to him, to lead him on to say, well, you just did it to defend yourself? Isn't that a proper interrogation technique here, again, to confirm that the person being interrogated did do it? You know, like, doesn't that happen all the time?
I would say yes, that happens all the time. And previous case law from, I believe, this court and other courts have accepted that type of deception or interrogation techniques. So I don't believe there would be anything. I wouldn't have a basis to argue that there would be anything wrong with that approach. But it's the whole circumstance of this, that where he's saying, you know, there's no consequences for telling me that. That portion is what makes this improper interrogation technique. I think federal courts have kind of looked at a totality of the circumstances approach, and they've looked at the particular subject, or they've employed a subjective analysis, and how this techniques would affect the individual. But throughout time, I don't think it's been that clear. Throughout time, there have been just objective focuses on the conduct of the police officers, and they've used different courts. I've cited a couple states in our brief where different courts have just focused in on the conduct of the police to say that these techniques are improper. They don't comport with our notions of due process, fundamental fairness, and that they have prohibited them per se. Federal courts have done it with violence. It's a per se ban against violence. And they do that without a totality of the circumstances. And that's basically what their rationale is, that this is not fair. This is not the type of system that we have here in America. And one of the cases that the state cites, Jenkins, which is a Ninth Circuit case, kind of lay out their rationale for why federal courts have kind of prohibited violence per se. And they said it serves no lawful purpose. It ends up invalidating confessions that are otherwise convincing, and it's universally condemned. And that same rationale could be applied to the techniques that were used here. There is no lawful purpose for misleading a person regarding his Miranda rights. That totally undermines what Miranda stood for and the protections that it afforded defendants. I think if we look at this case, either if we look at it under Miranda, totality of the circumstances, or a bright line rule, I think that this statement should be suppressed. So I think when you have cases where you're misleading a defendant regarding the consequences, you're going to end up losing confessions anyway. And I think it's safe to say it's universally condemned that you don't mislead defendants regarding their Miranda rights. So the rationale for keeping out violent acts, I think, applies equally to keeping out techniques that would undermine Miranda. Or
Mr. Roy, let me ask you, Justice Cherry asked Mr. Rogan, under totality of circumstances, whether the other circumstances that would justify allowing this confession to be admitted, what are the other circumstances here that you feel would support the district court's ruling, looking at the totality standard?
Well, I would agree with Justice Cherry, which said the looking at the techniques is overwhelming. But additionally to that, Mr. Robles Nieves did not have a lot of experience with the justice system. During his interrogation, he says, I've only had one ticket. That is my only interaction with Metro. I think even if you look at the interrogation, he has a fundamental misunderstanding of the system. He's concerned about his visa, and he's talking to Detective Young, and he made a diagram, and he tells Detective Young, oh, you can't put that in my record because when I leave, I'm going to come back, and that could affect my visa. So he clearly has no understanding of how the federal ICE works or how Metro works or the difference. He's kind of misunderstood there. He's from Mexico. He's not from America. I think also Detective Young was not a native Spanish speaker. There was testimony that he spent some time in a foreign country. I forget the actual country, but it wasn't Mexico. It was another, I think, South American country which could affect the dialogue between the two. So from the record, I think those would also support suppression in this case, but the overwhelming fact, of course, is the techniques that were used by the officer. I'd just like to point out, too, that this bright-line rule that we're, this court does not decide to, well, I should say Bessie is not that far divergent from existing Nevada Supreme Court at the time it was decided. If you go back and look at the cases Franklin, they looked at police deception, and there was no discussion of totality of the circumstances in that case. Passama, which was also kind of a deception, and they looked at it did announce the totality of the circumstances, but they did also say that certain interrogation techniques, either in isolation or as applied to a particular suspect, are so offensive to a civilized system of justice that they must be condemned under the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment. And then they went on to say, if these promises, implicit or explicit, tricked Passama into confessing, his confession was involuntary. So this approach by the Bessie court to just look at the objective interrogation take an objective approach looking at the interrogation techniques is not unfounded. It has been used by other courts. It has been used by this court before. As I said, it's been used by several state courts. I would say that the default rule is the totality of the circumstances, but there's sometimes that there's certain situations that sometimes the totality of circumstances isn't enough. And I think that's actually what Miranda said, and that's what the Miranda warning's for. It says sometimes under the traditional totality of circumstances, it's not sufficient protection against an involuntary confession. So the states that have gone on to prohibit certain techniques as per se, they've kind of taken that approach, that due process, that it's fundamentally unfair. I think that this case would be comparable to the other states that have taken per se approaches to certain interrogation techniques.
Did Young make a statement that he would not be, that the defendant would not be prosecuted? You will not be prosecuted. Is there a statement in the transcript at all?
Not exactly to that effect.
What does it say?
I was trying to find it. Robles Davis says, and I tell you, but you have to swear you will not lock me up. And Detective Young says, tell me. And Robles Davis says, you're just going to let me go, and that is it. And which part Detective Young keeps saying, you are leaving. He says, I'm going to leave. He wants some assurance from him. And he says, I don't have power over them. That's Detective Young saying, he's trying to save himself, but Robles Davis still wants that insurance, saying, okay, they're going to let me go, and that is it. And Detective Young says, that is it. He asks, you just want to know why, right? And then Detective Young says, yes, it's true. So I believe that is an implicit statement that after you tell us why you shot him, you are going to go home. Okay. And I believe the district court is entitled to deference.
But he did say that the victim signed a request for no prosecution.
Yes, he did. He said that, and he showed him, and he also said the victim has all the rights in this case. That's why this case is done. So if you view all that together, I think the district court's factual determinations are due deference.
Thank you, Mr. Royal, very much. Mr. Rogan, you have just about 3 minutes here left.
I want to get back to the question that was asked of Mr. Arroyo is, how do we differentiate between permissible and impermissible deception? How do we advise the police going forward what the proper techniques they could use? And the answer to that is that you can't draw the bright line test. That every court, most every court other than apparently Hawaii, looks at the totality of the circumstances. It's always going to be Monday morning quarterbacking. And Bessie recognized that when it said that the test for coercion is that the methods utilized by the police are of a type or not of a type reasonably likely to procure a false confession under the circumstances. And that's how we have to continue approaching this. Sometimes we'd like to have a bright-line rule saying the police can do this or the police can do that, but based upon the nature of interrogations and their volatile situations, that's not possible. It simply can't happen. We have to look at it afterwards and give police guidance going forward by saying, what you did in this case is wrong. Don't do that again. I also want to point out, too, that on the record appendix that was just cited by Mr. Arroyo on page 100, the actual transcript that was prepared and given to the district court never has that line, the third line down, that was cited by Mr. Arroyo. The record that was presented to the district court is beginning, and I tell you, and this is the respondent speaking, you have to swear you will not lock me up. And Detective Young says, just tell me. And then the respondent says, just going to, and then says something intelligible. What the respondent did was proffer his own interpretation of that unintelligible statement. But it was never testified to at the hearing before the district court. They presented no evidence whatsoever. They didn't put their interpreter up and say, this is what was said in Spanish, this is the interpretation. So that is outside the record and shouldn't be considered at all by the court in making their decision about whether there's an implied promise. There simply isn't. When it just furthermore supports the position of the state that this man knew what he was doing, the fundamental question in terms of whether a confession is voluntary is whether it's the product of a deliberate choice, rational free will. And he's acknowledging, you have to swear you won't lock me up. What does that tell us? He knows the consequences of what he's saying. And there's nothing in the subsequent statements by Detective Young that says, hey, whatever you say, we're not going to use against you. This man was advised of his Miranda rights from the very beginning and told that whatever he did say would be used against him. There's no further questions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Rogan. Mr. Royal, for your excellent arguments and briefs, and this matter will be taken under submission.